Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, with co-host Patricia Glover-Howard. Hi, Patricia.
Good evening, Bernice and guests and chatters.
Good evening. Well, Patricia will monitor the chat room and summarize your comments. Well, welcome to the callers, chatters, and members of the Haitian American Historical Society to research at the National Archives and beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy and history an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. If you have logged in as a guest and you wish to participate in the chat, please sign in through Blog Talk Radio. Well, the topic for tonight is Haiti and the Civil War with Marvin T. Jones. The Civil War is sometimes called the Second Haitian Revolution. For over 70 years, pro-slavers feared Haiti, and the enslaved and abolitionists found great hope from Toussaint Louverture and Haiti. Marvin T. Jones details the actions of enslaved and abolitionists who were encouraged by the Haitian Revolution, Haiti's own involvement in offering freedom to people of color, and why Haiti was so important to keeping alive the hope that all Americans would be free. Many African Americans today are descended from all who saw Haiti as a guiding light. Marvin T. Jones, a documentary photographer and filmmaker, is the executive director of the Chouan Discovery Group, a research, documentation, preservation, and presentation organization. Among the many accomplishments are 5 documentaries, 7 North Carolina highway historical markers, the funding of community organizations, a stage presentation, several articles, hosted conference panels, lectures, and an award from the North Carolina Society of Historians. Early in Marvin's career, he documented Haitian forts for UNESCO. So let me give a warm welcome back to Marvin T. Jones to research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, Marvin.
Good evening, Bernice and Patricia, and to the audience. Thank you for having me here.
Well, Marvin, I am happy to have you, and I want to start at your beginning. So tell us about the beginnings of your interest in Haiti.
It probably started when my brother brought home a Haitian classmate one Thanksgiving. They were both at Howard University. It was 1967, and I found his classmate pretty interesting. And I used to read articles about Haiti in Time Magazine and other publications that were available when I was growing up in rural North Carolina. About a year or two later, I came across the book Call Papa Doc, And I read it, and I was really fascinated that here was the first time I was reading about a black country, and this was a country where people spoke French, and some of them had studied in Paris, and it was a completely different history than what I knew of black people at the time. And later, I worked with Haitians at a warehouse in Chicago for the summer. And I found them different than other West Indians, and I wondered why. I said, it must be their history. And I returned to the history and looked into it and found, you know, very interesting story. I already knew about Toussaint Louverture, but I didn't know enough. A lot of people really don't know much about the Haitian Revolution. That it's 12 years old, that it was 12 years old before Haiti finally became independent. And so I started reading the history, excuse me, and saw the photograph of the Citadel, which is the largest fort Haitians built after the Revolution to defend itself against slavery. It's an immense building. It's 450 feet tall, 8 to 13 stories high, could hold 100 big guns. And I said, "How Haiti has a rather chaotic history. How were they able to, and the revolution was chaotic, how did they build something as magnificent as the Citadel Henry on this mountain peak?" And my career as a documentary photographer was beginning, and I decided I wanted to document it. I did not see much out there. I made inquiries at the Haitian Embassy in Washington. I got to meet C.L.R. James, who wrote the magnificent history of the Haitian Revolution called The Black Jacobins. And I visited James a few times. We had a meal, and then both of us went to the Organization of American States to study recent blueprints made at the Citadel, because there were plans to restore it. And so, being around James, reading his books several times, and going to libraries and researching in a way that I was not doing work that I wasn't even doing in college, I said, this is what I'm supposed to do. I had never left the U.S. before. I began studying French. I never really delved into a language that much before. And I just prepared to go to Haiti. I upped my gear, saved my money, studied the language, libraries, talked to people, met African Americans who had gone there as tourists. One editor had recommended that I go ahead and do the project. I just needed someone to tell me to go and do it. And so in 1977, when I was 26 years old, I took about 5 large bags with me, with cameras and lights and a sleeping bag and other things, a tripod and other things, and went to Haiti. I made arrangements with the Haitian government, and I slept in the Citadel for 4 nights. Had rats crawling on me for 3 of the nights. I learned, Bernice, I learned, do not sleep near your food. There were 2 rats that kept bothering me. And the 4th night, I got it, and I put the food in another room, and they left me alone. There were only 2 of them in the entire fort, I think. And I continued to return to the Citadel to document it because I kept having new ideas. It's so huge. There are other fortifications nearby. There's one behind the Citadel on another mountain peak. I'd go to that. I'd go to other forts, and I just kept on. And then finally, UNESCO asked me to document it because at the end of 12 years, restoration work had begun, and they wanted me to document its current state. And I knew the building very well. Again, it's a large fort, and so to me, it is the symbol of resistance to slavery. It is the symbol of the physical symbol of the determination of black people to be free. But to me, it's the greatest monument there is.
Yes,
that.
And I can imagine what it felt like to go to the various sports and to experience what it was like to be in that place and to just imagine what it was like back then before the revolution took place. So
well, there were
is there a comparison to you when you think of the forts? Tell us about the forts a little bit more and the burning of Washington, D.C. during the War of 1812.
Well, after the revolution ended, Haiti declared itself independent. Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who succeeded Toussaint in leading the revolution, ordered that forts be built on former guerrilla camp sites. Haiti is very mountainous. It's probably the most mountainous country in the Americas, even more mountainous than the Andean countries. Their mountains are higher, but it doesn't cover as much land as it does in Haiti, you know, per square mile. And so now these guerrilla campsites are fortified. There are 40 of them. Some of them are made out of earth. Some of them are masonry. And it made it possible. So, no country gave Haiti diplomatic recognition. Every country was looking for its chance to reinvade, reimpose slavery. So Haiti fortified itself. Now, the comparison to 1812, by 1812, Haiti had its forts in place and had the French, who were always plotting to return to Haiti with an armada like they did before, one time before, had they returned, the Haitians would have gone to their forts and they would have been well protected. Because the French would have been rolling little bitty 6-pound cannons, whereas these forts, particularly the citadel, had huge, long 32-pound cannons that are high up with a greater range, and they're high up and they're more destructive. But when you look at what happened in Washington, the British sailed up the Chesapeake Bay, passed the fort. They dropped off troops, went around behind the fort, came into Washington, burned down the White House, burned the White House, set it on fire, burned the Capitol, and Haiti was not going to allow that to happen. They were prepared to keep that from happening. James Madison and Dolly Madison had to flee into Maryland, and they had no backup. And Haiti was prepared for that. That's the comparison.
That's the comparison. Okay, so let's go back for a minute, because we don't talk, and, you know, I started off mentioning the revolution, the Haitian Revolution. What can you tell us about the Haitian Revolution?
Well, Africans had been running off into the mountains when the Spanish were the first colonizers on the island, of Hispaniola, and Haiti is the western third. And so for generations, you had Africans living in the mountains who had never been enslaved because their parents, their ancestors had run off. And, of course, during all that time, there are more Africans who are running off in the mountains and creating their own lives and what have you. And there were occasional revolts. There were occasional revolts, and there was one large one around 1757 that was put down, the Macandal Revolution. But then, in 1789, the French Revolution took place. So now you have the French who are supporting the king. You have one group who's supporting the king and the elite, the land elite, fighting against those who wanted changes. You had the French fighting each other. And the French Revolution carried on in Haiti. And so when you have whites in Haiti fighting each other, that gave the Africans in Haiti, and the reason why I say Africans, most of the black people in Haiti were African born, even to the end of the revolution. And so they really saw their chance. They burned plantations. They killed people. They ran back up into the mountains. They just laid waste to everything. Again, in 1791, and you had leaders that emerged like Biasu and Jeannot and Jean-Francois, and there was a coachman. Well, there was a man who had been enslaved who 20 years earlier, in fact, he had become free and got his own plantation, even had his own slaves, and his name was Toussaint Breda, and he gave himself the name of Toussaint Louverture when he rose up into leadership. So he was the fourth leader. He had been somewhat educated. He knew animal husbandry. He knew geometry. He had a lot of skills. He understood discipline because, after all, he had his own plantation. He was renting it, but he still ran his own plantation. He still had a relationship with his former owner. And so he brought with him a lot of discipline and a vision of what he wanted to see for the freedom of black people in Haiti. Well, so he was the fourth leader, and his troops were more disciplined than the other three. When in France, the French Revolution took power, and they killed the king and Marie Antoinette and so on, they eventually abolished slavery. They abolished it. And the leaders of the revolution, including Toussaint, had allied themselves with the Spanish. So when everything broke out, the French are fighting each other, the Africans are revolting, the British and the Spanish started grabbing parts of Haiti as well. So you have like a free fall, and the foursome are allied with the Spanish. But when Toussaint saw that the French Revolution has abolished slavery, he turned on everybody and joined the French Revolution and delivered his troops and all. And eventually he beat everybody, defeated everybody, became part of the French Revolution, and became the head general of Haiti, which was called Saint-Domingue at the time. That was the name of the colony. And you have Saint-Domingue, the French part. You have Santo Domingo, the Spanish part. And so he's now general of Saint-Domingue, and eventually he became governor. And eventually he conquered Santo Domingo, and he has the whole island. It wasn't long before Napoleon, who was rising at that time as well, wanted to do away with the French Revolution, and he did. And he decided he wanted to take over Haiti, reestablish slavery. And he amassed this huge armada. It was bigger than the Spanish armada, 60,000 soldiers, all these ships. And he also wanted to fortify the Louisiana Territory, which he had lost during the Revolution and had regained when he conquered Spain, because Spain had taken the Louisiana area and New Orleans. But it wasn't fortified. He had it by treaty, but he didn't have it by might. So he thought he'd send these 60,000 over to Haiti. They'd be there for a few months, beat all the black folks up, put them back in chains, kill all the leaders, and then go on to New Orleans and fortify it. Well, that didn't happen. The French got to Haiti, but they never left. Only 5,000 left Haiti. Most of them were captured by the British, who were waiting offshore for them. They never made it to New Orleans. Napoleon saw early on that he needed to sell it to Thomas Jefferson, or either he was going to lose it to Thomas Jefferson by force. And so that's how the U.S. got about one-third, the continental U.S. got about one-third of its territory due to the Haitian Revolution. How about that?
And I don't know how many people even realize that.
Well, that's how important the Haitian Revolution is. Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, Nebraska, Kansas, you know, own up, Montana.
Well, there was a question coming out of the chat room about how was Toussaint educated. And there was a response in the chat room stating that he was taught by his godfather and Jesuit missionaries when he was young. Do you
that's
have
correct.
Any other information about that?
Well, that's correct. That's who taught him. He was seen as bright and energetic and thoughtful, and so he received education. And he knew how to manage his affairs, and he knew how to manage his work. If you read C.L.R. James's book, you realize how brilliant he was. This man even had secret negotiations with the U.S. while he was Governor General. And the U.S. definitely wanted to reestablish Haiti, but they saw it to their advantage to negotiate with him. I think he was selling sugar for arms.
Mm-hmm. But then what happened to him?
When the French invaded, eventually some of his leaders gave up, and eventually he gave up and negotiated a peace. He was thwarted by the French. He went to a meeting he shouldn't have gone to, and they seized him. They immediately put him and his wife and his sons on a ship, took them to France, and within a few months he died. He died in a coal mountaintop prison in France. The prison is still there, and the room is there's a plaque in that prison room where he died. But the French started breaking some of the terms of the peace, and Toussaint's generals began fighting again. Dessalines, Pétion, Henri Christophe, and the rest. And you had guerrilla leaders that never gave up. You had guerrilla leaders that never surrendered to the French. In fact, Dessalines and Christophe and on were even fighting the guerrillas as part of terms of the French, and eventually they had to turn against the French, and so the war was then on until the end. A big factor was yellow fever, but the French always suffered from yellow fever. But this is the fighting that was going on all over. It was ferocious fighting, and all kinds of smart thinking and defeating the French. And so finally, one battle outside of Cap-Haïtien, which is my favorite town, which is where Toussaint and Christophe were pretty much from in that area, the Battle of Vertière, the French were finally defeated. And November, December of 1803, and it was negotiated that they would leave in a certain period of time, but there were British ships waiting offshore for them. So when they got on the ships, they were captured by the British and they were put in British prisons. But the revolutionaries of Saint-Domingue, a month later, declared the independent state of Haiti on January 1st, 1804. And, of course, Haiti is now over 200 years old. Dessalines is the first leader. After he dies 2 years later from an assassination, Henri Christophe and Alexandre Pétion, they split the country in half. And after Christophe dies, Pétion's successor reunites the country. But this is where we start going into the African American part of the story, right?
That's right.
Okay.
So take us.
Okay.
take us further now.
All right. We've got the basis of Haiti. During around 1798, when the Haitian Revolution was in full swing, Toussaint was pretty much governor general of the island, and all this news is getting out. You have black watermen black seamen who are on ships, and they're spreading the news about some of everything, including this revolution in Saint-Domingue, which becomes Haiti. And it's passed on to coastal watermen and people on shore that, hey, it looks like there's a black country coming up. You know, there's a big revolution going on, and the slave powers are not able to put it out, and it's led by a man named Toussaint Louverture. Well, in Richmond, Virginia, you had a man named Gabriel. He's also called Gabriel Prosser. He planned a revolt of his own, but it was thwarted. The revolt was found out. And when you drive down I-95 through Richmond, we're not talking about the bypass, I-95 through Richmond, and you get off at Broad Street. Now, some of you out there might have done that going to a conference or whatever, and you turn one direction, you go to the Marriott on Broad Street. But if you go in the other direction, downhill on Broad Street, just over the overpass is a marker for the execution of Gabriel and a Virginia Highway historical marker. And then you go a little bit further, not much further, like 50 feet, and a little bit further down, you'll see another plaque, site of the jail where Gabriel died, or where he was kept before he died. Well, Gabriel was influenced by the Haitian Revolution, and the records state that. And this is before the Revolution had even ended. There were other revolutions like Denmark Vesey in Charleston, South Carolina in 1822. Vesey was a waterman who was also connected to ships, pilots, and watermen. They knew what to do with boats and big ships. And the plan of that revolt was thwarted before it got started. The plan was to take ships and sell them to Haiti in 1822. And you had watermen that could do that all along the Atlantic coast. And finally, another big one was the Nat Turner Rebellion, which so many of us know about. It happened only a county away from where I grew up. And that the news of Haiti in 1831 and that Haiti is now, 25 or so years old, all this is going on. It's still going on up, you know, coming up the Atlantic from the Gulf Stream into the waterways of North Carolina and Virginia. It's coming up the Albemarle Sound in North Carolina, the news of Haiti. It's coming up the Chowan River, which you know, up the Albemarle Sound to the Chowan River. My organization is Chowan Discovery Group. I was born and grew up 4 miles from the Chowan River. And when the Chowan gets up to the Virginia border, it splits into two rivers, the Blackwater and the Nottoway. The Nottoway, that news goes up a little bit further up the Nottoway. And on the Nottoway, not far away, lives a man named Nat Turner in Southampton County, Virginia, near Jerusalem, which is now called Cortland. And so he begins his revolution. And in August 21st, 1831, and a lot of whites are killed, and it just terrifies the whole South. Two militias are sent from my county across the border to Jerusalem to stop this revolt. The oldest document in my family, I'm the seventh member of the family to possess it, belonged to my great-great-grandfather, Noah Robbins. And the document states that he is certified as a free man of color in Gates County, which also neighbors my county in Southampton County, and is entitled to all rights of free men of color. And I said, well, this man was a Choanoke Indian. Why did he particularly need this document? And I saw the 1831. I said, okay, I know what 1831 means. And so I looked at the date, and it's 4 days after the rebellion. Noah Robbins needed that document to prove that he belonged where he did and he was a free person. And he was born in 1800, and his great-great-grandson has a document, and it's about 6 feet from where I'm sitting right now. And that was spurred on by the News of Haiti, I believe, to Nat Turner, to that document being created in that time. There was a big backlash on people of color from the Nat Turner rebellion, but it was a chance. You had to take the chance. You couldn't endure slavery anymore. So that's where maybe Haiti had an indirect effect. That's one way Haiti may have had an indirect effect on my family. Looking at the waterways. But then there were other things going on. There were a lot of African Americans like Prince Hall and Absalom Jones and others. Paul Cuffey, the ship owner and ship captain, did at least one trip from Philadelphia to Haiti or New York, wherever Paul Cuffey was operating, maybe Boston, to Haiti. There were organizations that were calling for immigration to Haiti. And then Henry Christophe, about a few months before he died, he had a stroke. Revolution broke out, and he was taken up to the Citadel. I mean, he committed suicide, and Mrs. Christophe had him taken up to the Citadel, where his remains are still there. And I've slept within 50 feet of his remains and walked past them many times. Henry Christophe received a proposal in 1820 to bring in African-Americans from the United States. Christophe had nothing to do with France. He wouldn't entertain anything with France because they wouldn't even call him President Christophe. They wouldn't call his town Cap Haitien, what used to be called Cap Francais. They wouldn't even address the nation as Haiti. They still called it Saint-Domingue. So he wouldn't have anything to do with them. But Christophe was entertaining this idea of bringing it. He wanted the language to change to English. He wanted trained, skilled people, and he was interested in this idea of skilled people of color, free people, English speaking, coming into Haiti and making cultural changes. This was a man who built schools, he built roads, he built a navy, a treasury. He made the Citadel as large as it is because that was his district. He was the real builder of the Citadel. The orders were to build forts. He made the Citadel as large as it is. And so the first black medical training was established under Henry Christophe. It wasn't much, but it was a start. It was years before black medical training resumed, I guess with the founding of Howard University in 1868. And so, and perhaps Meharry College, and so, Dessalines was interested in African American immigration as well. Yes, Bernice. Hello.
Okay, so Marvin. With that information, we're going to take a quick break and come right back and continue this discussion, okay?
That's fine.
welcome back to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and you can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will have an expert to share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy and history questions. Remember, all of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of history and genealogy. All of my shows are available as a podcast immediately after the broadcast, and they can be downloaded from Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, TuneIn.com, and Stitcher.com. Well, you have been listening to Marvin T. Jones discuss the Civil War and Haiti. Now, Marvin, we have a special guest on the phone right now.
Okay.
And before you come back on, I'm going to bring on Mr. Daniel Filaming. He is the chairman of the Haitian American Historical Society. Welcome, Mr. Filaming.
Good evening.
You're live.
Yes.
Good evening.
My name is Daniel Filaming. I'm the chairman of the Haitian American Historical Society in Miami, Florida. Welcome to hear from us from the society, and we would like to say a few words. We are open for questions, and go ahead.
Well, yes. What I would like you to share with everyone is the mission of the Haitian American Historical Society.
Yes. Our mission is to let people know about Haitians. We Haitians, we did a lot of things in the world, but people don't even know about, and we like to, that's what the society is about, to portray that the Haitians is a nation. Haitians did a lot. Haitian participated in many wars. Haitian helped America to become independent. As a matter of fact, this week, next week, the October the 9th, we're going to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Haitian monument that we built in Savannah, Georgia, to commemorate the participation of our ancestors who came to Savannah, Georgia on October 9, 1779 and participated in the battle for American independence against the British.
That sounds like an exciting opportunity for individuals to attend the festival. And so they can find out more about this festival from your website?
Not even for the festival, but the whole event, because it's going to be a 3-day event where we're going to have a parade. We're going to have another officials from Haiti and other parts of the world. We have a group of Haitian mayors that are coming from many cities in Haiti coming to participate. And we also have the general public, and also we like to say thanks to the Savannah officials that helped us to have our dream come true, because it wasn't easy to have a Haitian monument in Franklin Square in Savannah, Georgia. And that's what we're very grateful to everybody, and to, that's a prayer to show people that we Haitians, we don't come from the boat like people day, but we shed our blood for this country in Savannah, Georgia, and we are proud of that, and we let people know that we have a lot to offer, and we don't receive that much. But this is if you go to Savannah, or if you also go on our website, which is HaitianHistory.org, HaitianHistory.org, org. You can see it's a lot from the organization, and it's many, many, many more things we want to do. And people should we a lot of people appreciate that we the Haitian did, and we open to for any sponsorship, anything people can do for to help us to make sure that that celebration coming. And also we have for that celebration we want to have say roots bands from Haiti, from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, and we also have some lectures from the universities in Savannah, Georgia, and we go and do a blast pass for the last 3 days. So you can go on our website and get more information in there, and also you can call us at 786-412-1014. 786-412-1014, and our email address is HaitianHistory@bellsouth.net. You get more information about the event that's going to happen on October the 28th, 27th, 28th, 29th. We usually celebrate that event on October 9th, but unfortunately, because of the hurricane in a few weeks ago, we had to postpone it for the October 27th, 28th, 29th. And go to our website and to find out, and we appreciate anyone that can come to come to Savannah and celebrate with us to show the world our appreciation for the, what the Haitians did for the world. It's not even for Savannah only. The Haitians did a lot for Venezuela, in Central America, for many other places. But next time I will give you more details on that. But we do appreciate that you open, you know, the waves for us to let to invite people to come to Savannah and come celebrate with us and know more about the Haitian history.
Well, thank you very much for coming on and sharing this information with us, because I've seen what the monument looks like, and it is beautiful. And I don't even know if a lot of people even realize that there's a monument in Savannah which depicts the role that the Haitians played in our Revolutionary War. And so thank you so much for sharing that information with us. And we'll go back to Marvin. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity, and good night, and keep up
good
the work.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, Marvin.
Yes.
You're on.
Yes.
Okay,
Mr. Fields-Amaze said about the monument. When you go to Savannah to the First African Baptist Church, it's at the end of Market Street. It's one of the oldest African-American churches in America. It claims to be derived from the first Black Baptist congregation in America. You will see the memorial to the Africans who fought for America in 1779, and Mr. Field and Amaze's organization funded and did everything to get that monument placed there. And I recommend everybody to see that monument. There's a drummer boy. There are six people shown. Five people shown, and there's a drummer boy. And the drummer boy depicts Henry Christophe, who was only 12 years old, and he was part of the invasion force that was fighting for American freedom. There was another Chavon who later died in Haiti. He died because he started a revolt before the Haitian Revolution really took place a year earlier, and he was at Savannah as well. So Haiti's done a lot. Haiti supported the Greek independence in 1821, the freedom struggles of Simón Bolívar and Miranda in Mexico. And so he's right. Haiti has done a lot for freedom in North America and in Europe.
So, Marvin, let's talk a bit about the armies of Haiti, and how would you compare the armies of Haiti to the United States colored troops?
Well, the Haitians had to learn some modern battle techniques. They had to learn how to use rifles, many, and artillery. They had to learn that they could not fight European armies the way European armies fought each other. They needed to stick with guerrilla tactics, and that worked best. They needed to have discipline. And, of course, they had black leaders. You had leaders who later became French generals like Toussaint Dessalines, Henri Christophe, and so on. But you also had guerrilla leaders who answered to no one but themselves, and they never negotiated with the French. They always fought the French. And then when you had, of course, U.S. colored troops, all of our troops had white commanders. We might have sergeants of color, and there are at least two or three USCT sergeants in my family, but beyond that, there weren't that many, you know, commissioned officers that were of color in the United States colored troops. However, the numbers were a lot bigger, 200,000 members of U.S. colored troops, and of course we had men in the Navy all along. So that's one comparison. One company in the famous 54th Massachusetts that's shown in the movie Glory, Company C, I believe, nicknamed themselves the Toussaint Guards. What Toussaint Louverture meant to African Americans was a kind of same kind of feel that Jack Johnson, Muhammad Ali, and Jackie Robinson and Joe Louis meant to African Americans. He was on a bigger scale, he was bigger than those men because he was a warrior. He was a diplomat. He was an administrator. He was a true groundbreaker. But what he meant to African Americans was the same as what we recall of Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali, and Joe Louis. And so a real hero, a real African hero, and his successors, Dessalines, Boyer, and Christophe, they all were interested in African-American immigration, and Jean-Pierre Boyer in the 1820s did indeed, with his colleague, Jean-Thos Granville, brought African-Americans to Haiti, and one of them was W.B. Du Bois' grandfather, Alexander Du Bois. And Du Bois' father might have been born in Haiti, but we don't know much. Du Bois didn't know much about his father, and neither do we. But Du Bois did know Alexander Du Bois, who returned, who left Haiti, and returned as when he was about 60 years old as a consultant for another wave of African American immigrants to Haiti. So there was always this back and forth. There were Haitians who called for African American abolition. There were African Americans who were supporting diplomatic recognition for Haiti. You had abolitionists, white abolitionists, who were doing the same. You had one journalist who even in Europe went to interview Henri Christophe's widow when she was living there in exile in Pisa, Italy. You had a lot of African Americans who were interested in what was going on in Haiti, and you had a lot of Haitians that were interested in the struggle in the United States.
So when you say that the Civil War is sometimes called the Second Haitian Revolution, tell us why you're saying that.
The South, all slave holding powers, looked at Haiti with horror. even during the Saint-Domingue Haitian Revolution, they looked at it with horror. They looked at any kind of independence. I mean, these were people that didn't want anybody to learn how to read, let alone be free. And so, the South the white Southern leadership was most taken back by the Haitian Revolution. And then when it became free, it was even worse for them. And they said, we do not want a Haitian Revolution in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and at the same time, you had black people and abolitionists who were saying, we want a Haitian Revolution in the United States. And so that's why the Civil War is looked at as the Second Revolution, because both movements were defeated slavery. Slavery was abolished in both of them. And people knew that the Civil War, even before it started, even before it ended, it would result in the abolition of slavery, and just like it was in Haiti. And so all along you had these references that Southerners and abolitionists would make to Haiti on one side or the other. You had one South Carolina senator who said, our policy with Haiti is plain. We can never acknowledge its independence. Well, ironically, that the Union would never acknowledge South Carolina's independence when it broke away. Consider the irony of that. Slaveholder interests were always calling for invasions of Haiti. The administration of Franklin Pierce plotted to invade Haiti in order to add it as a slave state. The South was always trying to add states so it could have an advantage in Congress. So there'd be more slave senators and more slave representatives. And so they wanted, that's why they added Texas. Texas, you know, you go to the Alamo and people say, oh, it's a symbol of Texas freedom. No, it's not. Well, yeah, maybe Texas freedom, but it's not a symbol of freedom, because Texas was a Mexican-held free territory. The Mexicans abolished slavery. The founders of what is now Texas state, they brought slavery back into Texas. That was why they moved there, was to expand slavery and add senators and add congressmen and add more power for slaveholding interest. And so invading Haiti could be another state. Southerners were also plotting to conquer other countries. In fact, one Southerner became president of Nicaragua briefly with that in mind. He was overthrown. He returned to South America. He returned to Central America, and the British caught him, turned him over to the Hondurans, and they put him up against the wall, and that was the end of that. But this is just a few years for the Civil War broke out. The South was planning to introduce slavery and take over territories in the Caribbean Basin, and Haiti was one of those places. And so I want to move on to Frederick Douglass. And one thing that warmed me, Henry Christophe had an abolitionist friend named Thomas Clarkson. Thomas Clarkson and Wilberforce University is named after him, advised Christophe about what to do for Haiti and where to move to bring in more education, to do this with agriculture, to do this with trade, to... Clarkson even showed one of Christophe's letters to the Tsar of Russia, hoping to curry favor with, you know, as many leaders in Europe as possible about what Christophe was doing. And there is even a book of Henry Christophe and Thomas Clarkson's correspondence. I bought it many years ago. I still cherish it. And Christophe died in 1820. And 23 years later, a month before Clarkson dies, he's visited by William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass. And when I came across that, I was just so pleased that Frederick Douglass got to meet Henry Christophe's friend, Thomas Clarkson, who who hosted Madame Christoph and their daughters for a few months after she left Haiti for good in 18, you know, after Christoph died. And so you had these ties that I got to bring out in the talk the other night that you attended. One of Christoph's advisors was an African-American named Prince Saunders, who was educated in Dartmouth and had gone to England, had met Wilberforce and Clarkson, moved to Haiti as a teacher, and he was an advisor. It was him who pitched the ideas of African-Americans moving to Haiti, and he continued to support that long after Christoph died. There were just so many interactions between African-Americans and Haiti. You had Haitians advising in an American newspaper, "We believe that the means to abolish slavery is to oppose force with force, the legitimate war being that which man undertakes for the conquest of his rights." So Haitians were telling Americans, "You got to fight for your freedom. That's what we had to do." And that indeed is what happened. John Brown. Yes,
with that happening, I mean, you are sharing with us history and information that perhaps we have not gotten in schools and people have not spoken of it, yet it seems like we've always been working together. I mean, it helped us. It helped give us that influence, if you will, to fight for our freedom. So tell us, what books have helped you in your research, and what books do you recommend to the audience so that they can learn more about Haiti and the revolution?
I'll give you three. The first is C.L.R. James's book, The Black Jacobins, and I had already referred to that book. And bless your heart, today you found that it's online in PDF form and people can download it.
That's right.
That's wonderful. Also, there's a book called Toussaint L'Ouverture and the American Civil War by Matthew J. Clavin. And that helped fill out a lot of what I'm talking about today, this particular book. And a fellow I know who's a professor at Georgetown, Maurice Jackson. I've known Maurice about 35 years. He and Jacqueline Bacon put together a collection of essays and historical documents called, and this book is called, African Americans and the Haitian Revolution. And so those are the three books I recommend on this subject. And you can read about other people. I mean, Frederick Douglass became a minister to Haiti in 1889, 25 years after Haiti became independent. You had soldiers who in the Civil War who styled themselves and named their children after Toussaint L'Ouverture, like Martin Delaney did for one of his sons. You had John Brown, who hoped that his raid would spur the Second Haitian Revolution. You know, after John Brown's death in 1859, Haiti held 3 days of mourning. They had a national memorial service in the National Cathedral, which I used to walk by in Port-au-Prince. They had programs of honor in several towns, and Haitians raised large amounts of money for the Brown family. And if you go into Port-au-Prince today, you'll see an Avenue John Brown that's been there ever since that time.
Right, and one of the things, you know, that we need to recognize is that we have a very large Haitian population in the United States. I mean, New York has one of the largest, but then we also have a large population in Florida and other states. And so when we're talking about history, we also need to think about, well, genealogy and records. And so I've been trying to find out, where can we find additional records, especially those that may be of Haitian descent? And so I did look at the Family Search to find out, well, did Family Search have any records? And for those of you who are searching, They do have Haiti Port-au-Prince civil registration from 1794 to 2012. And this civil registration includes records of births, marriages, and deaths from the city only of Port-au-Prince for the Republican calendar of 1792 to 1806. Now, also, you can check U.S. passport information and U.S. naturalization records on Ancestry. There may be more, and I would recommend that you all follow up with the HaitianHistory.org organization for additional resources. Now, Marvin, I just want to ask you one more question before we close out tonight. What type of research in your community has uncovered indirect ties to Haiti?
The main thing is there was an African American named Abraham Galloway who escaped from the Wilmington area in the late 1850s. He went up to Canada. He was a waterman, and he went up to Canada, and he got in with the Underground Railroad. He also learned some spy craft, apparently. I learned this from Harry Jones, who's a former curator of the African-American Civil War Museum. And he was part of what you could call John Brown II. After John Brown, while John Brown was being tried, his backers, and including John Brown's son, John Brown Jr., were plotting to launch another raid from Haiti. And Abraham Galloway was part of that. Well, Galloway, the plot never took place because the Civil War took out, and that preempted it. But Galloway went on a spy trip to help the Union Navy invade North Carolina, which they did in late 1861. They came to my community in 1862, and whenever Union guns showed up, that was your Emancipation Day, proclamation or no proclamation. and so that's de facto emancipation. You could go away with those guns and you're free. And so Galloway was spying in North Carolina, preparing for that invasion. And in his reports, he makes mention of one of my relatives who apparently was doing something, in preparation for this invasion, because when this relative, Parker Robbins, and his brother enlisted in January 1st, 1864, 60 years after the Haitian after Haiti was declared, exactly 60 years later, January 1st. 8 days later, both men are made sergeants. And Harry Jones said they were pre-preparing for that. They had had previous training, and that's why they became sergeants in 8 days. And Abraham Galloway, who was an agent in Haiti, a North Carolinian who was an agent in Haiti, had reported on what some members of my family were doing.
I understand that you're heading to Haiti in December. So what are you going to do there?
Well, I'm long overdue to return. When I used to go, I was single, and then I married, I became a homeowner, I became a father, I was an employer, and I pretty much finished everything I felt I could do in Haiti. But I found new reasons. The founding principal of my high school, Dr. C.S. Brown, founded a mission in Haiti 90 years ago, and it's still running. And I want to go back and document that mission. I want to go back to my beloved citadel. I have a friend there, an American friend there. Everything's in my favorite town of Cap Haitien. And I'm going with a group called Rebuilding Haiti, one trip at a time. It's the first time I've ever traveled with a group. But it's a good group. We have happy hours every month, And I'm looking. I'm really looking forward to this 5-day trip. Usually, I would stay a month and get sick, but I think 5 days will allow me to get in and get out without getting sick.
Well, I hope that you have a wonderful time and come back and bring us even more information. So, do
Great.
You have any parting words before we close out tonight?
Yes, I'd like for people to study the Haitian Revolution, to read James's book, to learn in depth what it took for African people to be free and all kinds of ways that were needed. People think maybe the Haitian Revolution might have been an overnight thing. It was a 12-year struggle. It involved defeating the British, the Spanish, the various French administrations or French directions. It involved maintaining that independence by putting up these difficultly built forts. We focus on the forts in Africa, but we don't give enough attention to the forts that were built to keep black people free. And just because you have freedom today doesn't mean you'll always have it. You can always lose it. And never forget that. There are forces that would love to re-enslave African Americans, and so I see them all the time, and so it's important to keep your own freedom, but also make it strong enough to where they can't even voice that opinion.
Well, Marvin, thank you so much for your closing remarks, and also for sharing information on Haitian history, the revolution, and the second revolution. And everyone else, I want to just thank everyone for tuning in tonight. And Marvin, your thoughts have helped to clarify some information about Haiti and the Civil War. So please remember, everyone, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, and research at the National Archives and beyond. You can continue this discussion on the research at the National Archives and beyond and at virginius.com Facebook pages. Also, remember to listen to the African Roots podcast with Angela Walton-Raji, and also watch for the Black ProGen Live with host Nika Soul Smith. Thank you so much for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander, with co-host Patricia Glover-Howard, and I look forward to you joining me next week. Good night, everyone. Good night, Marvin.
Good night, and thank you.
You're welcome.